Okay, let's review Rich Hill before we move on to other art, independent, and foreign films showing this weekend. Cynthia Haynes, take it away.
Mr. Kraske, I think you ought to lead off.
Haven't been clear yet, I just thought this was one of the great film experiences I've had the last 5 years.
Wow.
Just a poetic film that said so much to me, with characters I will find memorable for a long time, and individual scenes, individual moments, like the one boy whose name I'm going to look for here real
quickly. We've got Harley, Andrew, and Apache.
With his mother, they're in court. It's a dramatic moment in the film, and the son sort of nuzzling his mother, son troubled with lots of issues he's dealing with, sort of nuzzling up to his mother, and the camera sort of lingers on them for a little bit, and some of the shots of the town, I just thought, again, spoke so clearly about the challenges of rural America, the challenges of that so many folks in our listening audience face in Missouri and
something
Kansas.
I was just going to say, it's interesting, talking about how it was photographed, they often shoot Andrew, who's the most hopeful and untroubled of the boys.
Yes.
She's always shooting him from the back, and he's walking forward, and we're like moving forward with this kid who does seem to have the best chance.
Well, we talked about hope with Tracy, and he gives us the hope.
He's doing well, and they're all doing well. They're doing better.
His smile lights up the screen,
and
you see, and his ability to sort of navigate these incredible circumstances that he's up against.
It's called resilience.
I've
worked with troubled kids my whole career, and it's called resilience, and some kids have it, and some never find it.
He does.
This is a kid, in analyzing his life to date, says that God's obviously been busy with other folks.
Right. Yes.
What a thing to say.
That will be something else I'll remember for a long time. It just took my breath away when he dropped that line.
You know, in this day and age of reality television, I mean, I had certain reservations before I saw the film as to what extent these kids were being exploited or to what extent the families were naive. I think the conversation with Tracy was really helpful because of her sensitivity. I don't get a sense that, you know, she was in there ready to exploit anybody, that in fact her sensibility to the community was significant, having come from that.
This film is five levels above anything reality TV I've seen. As I said to her, there's a little poetry to this film, which again I thought just works so well, so appropriate, and it helped you get through watching some difficulties with so many of these.
Steve, I haven't seen you so animated.
I just was so taken with it.
Really have.
And the other interesting thing is that the of the three boys, a couple of them are, I hesitate to say, not likable because they're kids, and you can find something to like about everybody, but they're troubled. They're fighting all the time, tooth and nail, with their parents and their siblings, and you just go, if I was his teacher, I'd go, sit in the back. I mean, and she kind of alluded to that. These kids are looked down upon, if seen at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The access she got, again, I just thought was absolutely amazing.
I don't want us to move on before I mention that tonight there will be a screening of this film at the Screenland Crown Center at 6:30. And immediately afterwards, there's going to be a Q&A with Tracy and two of the young subjects of the film. And the movie will also be showing at the Glenwood Theater for a week. So please, if you have any interest in seeing this movie, see it either at Crown Center or at Glenwood within the week. Don't put it off. It may not be here.
This movie will knock the snob right out of you.
That's a good one.
It'll break your heart, too, as you said so well in your review, Bob Butler. Okay, let's move on to another film that's sort of along these lines.
Yeah, there's a tie-in here.
This film is titled Boyhood. It's a brilliant coming-of-age story about time and how it changes us, Steve Walker, and you're very high on this
film. Very high on this movie. Extraordinary movie about an ordinary family. Richard Linklater took 12 years to make this film. He gathered his cast together for about a week for 12 years. The boy named Alan Coltrane was 6 when he met him, 7 when they started filming it. And Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke play his divorced parents. And seamlessly, there's no big trumpet announcement. Okay, now he's 7, now he's 8, now he's 9. It's just seamlessly put together that we watch this life, we watch this boy grow up. There has never been a movie that did this. I was so incredibly moved by mm-hmm. it as I am now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This
yeah.
movie.
Well,
wow.
Yeah. Linklater took a huge risk, anticipating that this young boy would follow a certain trajectory and help him create the movie that Linklater had in his mind.
Yeah.
And he was very lucky because this kid is so charismatic, such a decent, wise young man. I was also impressed with the fact that Ethan Hawke, the dad, who was just kind of a weekend dad, was really a basically decent person.
Yes, right.
And the same with
the
mother.
Which you didn't expect when the
film
began.
Which you didn't expect. You mm-hmm. expected some kind of, you know, issues. And so it was so delightful to see that there was a mother who cared, that she worked at night, that she went back to school, that she wound up with a career. I mean, it was such a positive.
And made very bad choices in men,
yes,
though,
in
however.
Men, yeah,
right.
What
true.
Makes this interesting to me is that drama is about conflict, and yet this is a film that really isn't about conflict.
Good
it's
point.
A, it's
yeah.
about the passage of time, and what, and that in and of itself is a form of conflict, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Did it affect you the way it did me, Bob?
You know what? It's funny. It didn't affect me so much while I was watching it as in the days afterward.
I tried to describe it to someone right after watching it. I texted him, Cynthia,
mm-hmm,
said,
did.
"I've just seen the most extraordinary movie." I can recall.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even talk to my best friend trying to describe it.
Yeah. You know, and with all due respect to your feelings about this film, and I felt differently about it. And having said that, my wife saw it with me, very much enjoyed it, and had reactions very similar to yours. I found it a little long.
Okay.
It left me a few times. And I also felt like that once you get beyond, and I'm going to cheapen this is the wrong word, but the gimmicky mm-hmm. idea of using the same
sure.
actor all the way through. And I don't mean to belittle
right.
this tremendous achievement that this director pulled off by,
right.
by doing this. I just wasn't sure I walked away with much in the same manner that I walked away with a whole lot from mm-hmm. having watched Rich Hill last
and
night.
And that's interesting to me, Steve, because you've had your son on the show right before
yeah.
he went off to college, and I was thinking of friends of mine who have kids about to go to college,
yeah.
and I just said, be prepared. It's going to put you in your home
yes.
having experienced your
true.
Own kid grow up. I can't imagine you felt as impassive about it as you did. I'm surprised.
You know, I hope people are not frightened away by the length, because it really is, I think, worth the effort of sitting through. I mean, how do you condense 12 years of filmmaking
yes.
down to
yes.
almost 3 hours? I mean, that was a tough job to begin with.
I thought Ethan Hawke was tremendous.
Oh,
in this.
I thought Patricia Arquette was tremendous
I did
as well.
Too.
Yeah.
I will remember their performances
yeah.
going away,
yeah.
having said what I said about this
yeah,
film.
Yeah, the kid's
yeah.
not showy. He's not actor-y like child actors. He's just as normal as can be.
Yes. Yes.
We've got a scene here with Ethan Hawke as the dad talking to Mason and his sister, who's, by the way, played by Linklater's daughter. And so she ages 12 years as well. But they're talking in the car here.
Talk to me. Samantha, how was your week? I don't know, Dad. It was kind of tough. Billy and Ellen broke up, and Ellen's kind of mad at me because she saw me talking to Billy in the cafeteria. And you remember that sculpture I was working on? Well, it was a unicorn, and the horn broke off, so now it's a zebra, okay? But I still think I'm going to get an A, right? Mason, how was your week? Well, Dad, you know, it's kind of tough. Joe, he's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom. He wanted me to smoke them. But I said no, because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
Dad, these questions are kind of hard to answer.
What is so hard to answer about what sculpture are you making?
It's abstract.
Okay, that's good. See, that's, I didn't know that. I didn't know you were even interested in abstract art.
I'm not. They make us do it. But, Dad, I mean, why is it all on us, though? You know, what about you? How was your week? You know, who do you hang out with? Do you have a girlfriend? What have you been up to?
I see your point. So we should just let it happen more naturally, right? That's what you're saying. Okay, that's what we'll do. Starting now.
Great scene with parents who struggle to get their kids
yeah.
to talk to them sometimes.
So,
I live in that world.
So the yeah. high-pitched voice at the end was the young boy
mm-hmm.
At age 7. You get a sense there of, you know, I don't want to sound too pretentious here, of it being a very organic story.
Yes.
There was a lot of improvisation. They brought a lot of their own dialogue to the individual scenes, and you got a sense of that in that car scene.
Yeah, and what, like I said earlier, it doesn't announce now Mason's nine. What
the next scene is
seamless from the last one,
cool.
And you go, oh my
Very
gosh,
cool.
He's 4 inches taller and skinny.
Yeah.
He was a pudgy little seven-year-old. Yeah. I predict it's going to win Best Picture. I absolutely think
it will.
It's such an accomplishment. It can't be ignored, can it, really?
Yeah.
I sound like Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. You will not be ignored. This film will not be ignored.
Well, let's do this. Let's take a very short break. When we come back, we'll talk about several other art, independent, and foreign films now showing Mood Indigo, Wish I Was Here, A Most Wanted Man, which is Philip Seymour Hoffman's final full role in a film, the new film with Gore Vidal and several others. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation about the presidency of Gerald Ford or our visits with presenters from this week's TEDxKC speaker series, you can find those at kcur.org. In the week ahead, Midwestern boys who grew to be prominent in industry, business, and the arts, plus dueling pianos, and Morgan Fairchild. What else could you want? That's all coming up next week here on Up to Date. This hour, we're talking about the latest independent films now showing in Kansas City. We're visiting with Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. Let's move on, Cynthia, to Mood Indigo, about a wealthy young man who cares for his wife through her unusual illness.
I'm going to take this.
Bob.
Well, what can you say about a movie that... No, wait, that's a different movie. Mood Indigo. It's made by Michel Gondry, who gave us a pretty interesting film in the Eternal... what is it?
Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Right, the Jim Carrey movie about memory and forgetfulness. What he's done here is given us a movie that for the first half is Pee-wee's Playhouse, and for the second half is an Ingmar Bergman suicide drama.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know what he had in mind. We start out with this inventor in Paris who lives in a fanciful house. It appears to be a subway car stretched between two skyscrapers. He's played by Romain Doury, who has been in lots of films. You'll recognize him when you see him. He has a playful existence. His tap doesn't have water come out of him. It has eels for dinner. He has created a machine that mixes drinks based on which Duke Ellington composition you play on the keyboard. It's fun. It's bright. It's very colorful. Actually, it's a little too fun and bright because it wore out my... I burned out on it quickly. Yeah. Anyway, he meets and falls in love with Chloe. Chloe is not only the title of a Duke Ellington song, but she's played by Audrey Tautou.
Oh.
Amelie herself. They fall in love.
Love that film.
Their courtship, they get on a sort of a swan boat that floats them around Paris. And then she starts to get sick, and then the movie starts to lose its color, and it becomes gray and black and white, and he has to go out and get a job to support the medical bills, and what the hell? Where'd all those good feelings go? Well, they went away. What can I tell you? It's almost perverse in going from bright colors to...
It's wacky, I think, is a word. Surreal is a word. Odd is a word.
Yeah. The trouble is that it doesn't track emotionally. If you're going to start out in this totally frivolous thing and then try to bring it into this deep, dark, mourning situation...
It just doesn't work.
It rolled off my back.
You know, I was thinking of Micmacs, which is a fanciful film where, you know, you had inventions and I was so disappointed in this film because I agree with Bob. It just took this dive straight down toward the end of the movie, and I thought
it's subconsciously. Right. I mean, what am I? Not subconsciously. it's obviously very proud of its quirkiness.
Yes,
and it draws attention to itself a great deal. Let's see how weird we can make the next scene, and it's just nonstop and assaultive almost.
Yeah, assaultive is that's a good word for it because you get, you know, cute is okay up to a point, and then you start drowning.
The schizophrenic nature of this bothered the two of you too.
Am I hearing that right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not based in one note of reality.
Yeah,
and it's just
it doesn't have to be if it's well thought out.
Sure, but it didn't. I didn't respond to it.
No.
So reviews for Mood Indigo. Steve Walker, how about Wish I Was Here? A dramedy about an out of work actor who struggles with his middle class L.A. family.
Yeah, he does. And Zach Braff made Garden State, which was a big indie hit several years ago. Yeah. He struggled to get this made, finally did, and he plays a father and and husband. He's an actor struggling. They don't have much money. Kate Hudson is his wife, who works for, she's basically the bread earner, works at a utility company, not a very glamorous job.
Yeah.
They have two kids at private school. Well, his dad, played by Mandy Patinkin, has been fronting that bill, and his dad gets sick with cancer and forces them to reevaluate their life and their choices, whether it's Zach Braff's career or where the kids go to school, the choices they've made about the mom being the breadwinner.
Mm-hmm.
The first half hour, I found it very, very predictable and potty. It was all about, oh, they've got a curse jar in their kitchen. We've seen that 400 times.
Mm-hmm.
But then Kate Hudson, who I've not seen in a movie for years,
yeah,
because I didn't go see her romantic comedies or any of that stuff. Mm. She is quite good in this and has a very deep, complicated character to pull off. She was much more fun to watch and important to the film than Zach Braff's kind of goofy Scrubs personality.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they didn't see it.
It's all on you.
Well,
we have a clip here, Doctor.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Zach Braff's kind of contemplating his life with a rabbi, I believe, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
What brings you to Temple, Aiden?
When we were kids, my brother and I used to pretend we were these superhero spacemen. We'd go out to the woods behind our house and pretend it was this mystical planet, and we were the only ones who could save everybody. But I've been thinking about that a lot lately. Remembering those fantasies for the first time in, like, 14 years.
What do you think it means?
I don't know, and I'm even embarrassed to say this out loud, but if I can't say it to you, I can't say it to anybody. Do you think God is trying to tell me something? Trying to guide me in some way? And if you say he works in mysterious ways, I will run out that door.
That's Zach Braff. I liked it a lot, especially because of Kate Hudson's performance.
Okay. Sounds good. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the latest independent films now showing in Kansas City. How about Bob Butler, Gore Vidal, The United States of Amnesia? It's a documentary about the life of author Gore Vidal.
I don't know how much you know about Gore Vidal, but he was a misanthrope who managed to be charming. He never met a person or an idiot that didn't make him really angry. At the same time, he was so funny. He was so observant. He irritated liberals as much as he irritated conservatives. You may remember him getting into a near fist fight with William F. Buckley during the 1968 political convention coverage. I mean, anybody who thought of putting those two together, Gore Vidal was a great novelist. He wrote screenplays. He wrote the screenplay for Ben-Hur, for crying out loud.
Wow.
He wrote political commentary, but his greatest creation, I think, was Gore Vidal. He came from aristocracy, American aristocracy, but he was contemptuous of them. He sided with the little guy, but he thought the little guy was an idiot for putting up with what the little guy in this country puts up with.
Hmm.
He was gay long before it was fashionable to be gay, and openly so. It's just an incredible, interesting
profile
of, yeah, of a man who had so many incredible quotes. You know, he says the foremost wonderful words in the English language are, "I told you so."
Well, he also had so many extraordinary careers,
yeah,
from writer to occasionally acting to frequent talk show guest to politician.
No, he died about 2 years ago.
No, he's not. Yeah. Politician. Commentator on just the zeitgeist for as many years as he did is quite
something.
Well,
he literally spoke from his grave.
You're right, in the opening scene. Yeah,
and he wasn't well. But I'm trying to think of, the beginning of all of these arguments that you see on television these days between the left and the right. I mean, the intelligent banter with William F. Buckley and with Gore Vidal was at a level that none of this conversation reaches today, in my opinion.
That is until William F. Buckley called Vidal a faggot and Buckley called Vidal called Buckley a crypto-fascist. Now, that's the kind of TV you don't get anymore.
Yeah. Right. You don't hear that anymore.
1968. Right? Wow.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we have a clip here, too, Bob.
You know, I don't know what this is.
Jack Kennedy and Tennessee Williams.
He's talking about Jack Kennedy and Tennessee Williams, yeah.
I took Tennessee over there one day, and Jack was putting up targets. And he'd got out guns. And we were going to do some target practice. Jack begins, and he goes, bang, bang. He looked wonderful doing it, but, you know, didn't really hit the target. And Jack said, well, Tennessee, don't you want to try this target right here? Tennessee, yes, well, you know, I'm totally blind in my left eye, but I don't mind giving it a try. Bang, bang, bang. He hit every target.
That's from Gore Vidal, The United States of Amnesia, and Bob Butler.
I just, I wish I'd known him.
Yeah.
After this, you really wish you'd known him.
Yeah. I hope there's not, this is not the last documentary about him, because he was fascinating.
Hmm. It's at the Crown Center this week.
All right. Eye Origins, Bob Butler, a science fiction drama about a biologist studying the human eye who makes a startling discovery.
I'm going to just sort of as a blanket statement say, never trust a movie that has a pun in the title. Eye Origins, it's spelled I as in letter I, Origins, but it's about a man who's obsessed with eyes, E-Y-E-S. Michael Pitt plays a scientist who's, obsessed with eyes. He takes photographs of strangers' eyes. He is working in a lab where he's trying to develop a gene that will allow a kind of worm to grow its own eye because, he points out, many Christian apologists point to the human eye as proof of God's existence because they can't understand how nature produced this wonder. Mm. And Michael Pitt, the scientist, is going to do it in the lab. Then he falls in love with a girl with beautiful eyes. And they're going to have, you know, they're going to get married, but something happens. So he marries his lab assistant, played by Britt Marling. You know who Britt Marling is?
No.
Did you ever see Another Earth about the two Earths in the sky?
No.
Same director.
She's really good.
She's really good. Same director, Mike Cahill, made both these films. Anyway, the movie wants to get metaphysical, but it lost me long before it got to anything like a payoff. You folks seen this yet?
Yeah.
It's a very low-budget, convoluted film. I walked out of there just mumbling, thinking, what did I just see?
I liked Michael Pitt a lot, and I thought about an hour of it was build-up to the real story. So it took a while to engage for me.
I was kind of the opposite. I thought the build-up was kind of interesting, and I thought the payoff was a letdown. So there we go.
Well,
diametric opposites.
Right.
Bob Butler, we have a clip here from Eye Origins.
I believe this is Michael Pitt and Britt Marling in the lab.
Gunther Bachmann? Martha Sullivan, U.S. Embassy, Berlin. I know you by reputation, of course.
That can't be good.
Men with good reputations usually aren't much use to me.
What about women?
You should go to India.
Can't go to India.
Can't or won't?
India is not Boise, Idaho, Karen.
There is someone there with Sophie's exact iris pattern. And the eyes and the brain are connected. If the cellular structure in the eye is reoccurring from person to person, then maybe something in the brain carries over as well, like a neurological link. Maybe the eye really is some kind of window to the soul.
Window to the soul. I didn't see that line coming.
Blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
400 miles away.
Not so high on Eye Origins as we talk about the latest art, independent, and foreign films with our critics here today, Bob Butler, Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker. Let's move on to a film I think I want to go see. I'm interested to hear what our critics have to say about it today. Most Wanted Man, Cynthia Haynes. It's about a German spy who stalks an Islamic terror suspect.
This is, for me, the most entertaining movie I've watched all summer.
Nope.
I thought it's a fantastic adult film.
Great.
No guns going off, no car chases. It's an espionage film that absolutely works. It's based on a John Le Carré novel set in Hamburg post 9/11. It was directed by a guy named Anton Corbijn, who does has been known for his music videos. He has quite a reputation. So he had a very interesting visual style in creating this movie. And as you mentioned earlier, Philip Seymour Hoffman's last performance in a film. And it really does color your reaction to what you see on the screen, because you see a broken man who drinks too much, who is lonely, but has this passion and you know, comes from the old school of spies. So, and he's got a very quirky German accent, which we'll hear in a clip in a moment. Willem Dafoe is in it. Robin Wright, she plays an American intelligence officer who looks like Adolf Hitler with her dyed black hair swooping across her forehead. La Carré did not think much of the American intelligence network. Anyway, it's a fantastic cast. I found it engaging and exciting at the same time. So,
well, Cynthia, you've just sold me, I think.
Walker? It's worth
I enjoyed
time.
It a lot, and it's very timely as well.
You in the same place with Cynthia in terms of your enthusiasm level?
Not quite that much, yeah. But that's timely because the terrorist that they're sort of following is from Chechnya.
Right, and he's Russian father, Chechenian mother.
Right, right, mm-hmm. And so there's some of that complication. And she's right, though. It's very adult, it's very intelligent, and it kept me interested.
Well, and it
for
also
the 2 hours.
Yeah, and it shows how the intelligence community can suck in, just, you know, as because of a suspicion, innocent people who are, you know, caught in these dragnets. And
now, when you think about a John Le Carré novel, you think it can be pretty complicated. Is this movie, can you follow it?
Or? Oh, yeah. Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Yeah.
What makes it interesting for me is that, like all Le Carré great books, there's a moral ambiguity everywhere. Remember The Spy That Came In From the Cold, that one of his first big hits.
Tinker Tailor Soldier
it's,
Spy.
It's about people. It's about people who... Is there honor among spies? I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
Well, there's not honor among his government collaborators,
that's
however.
For sure.
Especially his American ones, and that may be his feelings, you know, coming out about America.
He wrote a beautiful piece in the New York Times about Philip Seymour Hoffman, the July 20th issue, Staring at the Flame. It's worth reading.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman's role here, his performance, is
incredible.
It's
intense. It's
accented. He's a German spy, so he's got that.
But it's
accent.
An unusual German accent, and apparently he learned early on as an actor that if you're going to do accents, take it to another direction from the direction that your fellow actors are going. So
interesting. Yeah.
You'll note in this clip, it doesn't really quite sound like a German accent.
Let's listen.
Gunther Bachmann? Martha Sullivan, U.S. Embassy, Berlin. I know you by reputation, of course.
That can't be good.
Men with good reputations usually aren't much use to me.
What about women? This is my colleague, Diana Fry.
Hello?
Hello.
She sails and spies. I don't sail. Hamburg's a long way from Berlin. What are you doing here?
Me? I'm just an observer.
I've been observed by Americans before. Usually doesn't end well.
From what I'm hearing, we're not the ones you need to be worrying about.
That's from a most wanted man, Philip Seymour Hoffman's final full role, and pretty three thumbs up here for that film from our critics. How about Life itself, Bob Butler? This has a lot of folks talking. This is a documentary about film critic Roger Ebert, who died last year.
We talked about this last month, but we didn't actually review it. I think it's a fantastic piece of work. Because it isn't just about a man and his career, although, let's face it, this guy had a tremendous career. What I found to be so moving about it is that it's about a life turned around fairly late in life. Roger Ebert, how shall I put this delicately? He was a very talented son of a bitch. And in fact, Gene Siskel's widow at one point remarks that when she was 7 months pregnant, Roger Ebert stole the cab she had flagged down. Now, he was incredibly talented. He turned the whole business of reviewing upside down. He made it legitimate in a way it had never been before. But it wasn't until he got married late in life that he kind of discovered what it means to be, a real human being. And it's a movie about redemption.
hard to watch, I'm told, in places.
It's very hard to watch.
At the end of his life.
Because why, Steve? Just fill us in here.
I don't want to be...
This is a tough one, yeah.
He loses his jaw to cancer. I think everyone knows that.
Yes.
And wasn't able to speak or eat for many years. A life so horrible, I can't imagine. But what's left of his face is the chin, which you can see through because there's no jaw there. Mm. And you see him talking and being fed through the tube and at his doctor. It's one of those medical examples of things that where you have to, I have to put my hands up in front of the screen.
His wife really opposed the filming of some of those scenes, and then she claims after the fact that, well, you know, she accepts it and the judgment on the part of the filmmaker. I think this is really a film that happened because of her. I think she wanted to burnish his reputation and after his death. And my husband used a line. He says he thought that this was an exercise in immodesty. And to a great extent, I think it was.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I wasn't quite as enthusiastic about it as a lot of people have been.
So be forewarned, it's hard to watch.
Yeah, and
they're
saying this will definitely be a film nominated for Best Documentary.
We have a clip, Bob.
You know, I honestly don't know which one this is.
Well, this is Gene Siskel's wife actually making that comment about that taxi cab, and Chaz, his wife.
Chaz was probably more life-altering for him than his TV show. She really, really liked him for what he was and not who he was.
She changed his life immeasurably. She changed his personality. Hey, I was 8 months pregnant and Roger grabbed the cab in front of me in New York. It's not that kind of guy now. I think Gene was so happy that Roger found his mate.
He was 50 years old when we got married. He used to tell me.
That's from Life Itself. And the relationship between Ebert and Siskel was what?
Prickly. I mean, a jealousy, actually. Mm-hmm. Roger Ebert was very jealous of Gene Siskel. He had more education. He was of a, you know, better class.
And he was at the Tribune and not the Sun-Times.
Right,
So it was all about that rivalry as well.
Okay, how about some local events coming up, Steve Walker, or something happening at the Tivoli? Here?
Well, there's a movie opening that never opened in the United States by Eric Rohmer, the great French director, called A Summer's Tale. It's about a college student, male college student, visiting the Brittany Coast and relationships he establishes with three young women. I clicked on to watch it that Jerry at the Tivoli sent me and thinking, oh, I'll just kind of look at it because the show's coming on. I sat there and watched the whole thing. Yeah. So it's really an entertaining movie.
How about something else at the Tivoli? World War I films. This is the 100th anniversary, obviously, of the start of the war. A BBC miniseries coming up that might be interesting.
Right. It's never been shown in the U.S. It's about the lead-up to World War I. It's presented in conjunction with the World War I Museum here in Kansas City. And it'll be showing Saturday, August 9th at 11 a.m.
Is it good? That's this Saturday. That's tomorrow.
Yeah, it's supposed to be fantastic. The Royal Cousins at War, a BBC documentary, 1:30 p.m. Saturday, August the 16th. Also want to mention that the Glenwood Arts is launching a campaign. They are in jeopardy. The mall in which they're located is going to either be leveled or redesigned. And so you can go to www.fineartsgroup.com, save the Glenwood Arts, or you can go to the website, thenewmetcalf.com, and vote or express your opinion about the value of the Glenwood Arts Theater, and it has been significant in the film community.
So here we go again.
Yes.
We save the Tivoli. Can we save the Glenwood Arts?
Let's hope so.
Yeah. Okay. I want to thank Steve Walker, Bob Butler, Cynthia Haynes for coming in. Always good to have you guys. What a great
hour. Thank you.